Now, today's roundtable. The fight over whether more of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s papers can and should be auctioned, and new evidence that there was no link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. But before we get to those stories, I'd like to hear from our panelists on the segment we just heard about the RAND Corporation's HIV and AIDS religion study. Joining today's panel, Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University and columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. So welcome, everybody. And Nat, I just love your title, Professor of Future Studies. You can't go wrong with that. What do you think of this study on AIDS and religion? Is it surprising to you, or is it just par for the course?
Actually, it's not surprising to me, although the study is dated, and I know they validated it because they've looked at some other longitudinal studies. But it doesn't surprise me that there's a relationship between people who go to church and perhaps that the relationship, the fact that they go to church or a long-term congregation means that they're less likely to want to conduct themselves in behavior that most of us would consider to be abhorrent. I would say this, that the study reflects, it suggests to me that the church, and particularly the black church, has been negligent in looking at the potential that it had to help to solve the overall crisis of AIDS within the black community. I think the idea that we focus so much on abstinence as opposed to protection, and then, of course, the golden rule means that, you know, there is an opportunity here. Now, whether or not this is going to have long-term implications for the black church, I doubt that it will. The church is still pretty much afraid of AIDS, but everything helps.
Mary, in fact, we had this debate earlier in the week on our show about what the role of the black church should be. Basically, Nat is arguing that the black church probably won't pay, not as if there is one black church, but black churches will not in general pay attention to evidence like this and change their stance on AIDS outreach. Do you think this could have a positive impact?
Well, I think there are a couple of problems. One, there's a problem with the study. I'm aware of several other studies that show that people who have traditional values or are religious, you can be the one because you can be humanistic without going to church, although I'm religious, I hasten to add, but that those people are less likely to get HIV in the first place because they're less likely to engage in risky sexual behavior. If that's true, then there's some pool problems, which I won't go into, with how this study is done, and I'm suspicious of it too because one inference from it would be that perhaps you ought to finance churches from federal grants or something to get them involved. However, black churches, there's a major problem in that if they are so anti-sex and so homophobic, especially the evangelical ones, one of which I belong to, that it's a problem getting them to deal with this no matter what the study shows. But
Absolutely.
What they should do is take this as well as looking at the side of Christianity, which is to be humane and to accept everybody and love everybody and run with this and see if they can do something to help us solve this major HIV problem.
Joe, I just have to go to the last part of it. As someone who grew up Catholic, Catholics using condoms the most. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's long been known that that the Catholic person on the street doesn't necessarily follow all of the teachings of the Pope, and that's been the case for many, many years, perhaps centuries. And I guess this is just one more study to indicate that.
All right. Well, let's move on in our topic. There's a new set of King papers to be auctioned, very controversial. Now, this week marked the 39th anniversary of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, and a new set of King documents will go up for auction in April. Now, this latest announcement has the King heirs questioning the authenticity of the papers and the legality of the intended auction. So there's an elderly woman who claims to be a King family friend. She said she got the papers in a debt settlement with a radio station connected to Dr. King. And the King family says if she doesn't have documentation of the transfer, do the papers belong to her or to the King estate? Mary, who do you side with?
I side with the King estate in this regard because the papers ultimately are Martin Luther King's paper. Even though I have problems with the King estate and the King family and all the different things that they do, some of which are very problematic, and Martin Luther King probably wouldn't even do them. But in this case, we'll have to sort out who owns these papers. But I am excited about the finding, and I don't mind that they're making the claim. If this woman is really correct and they were given to her to settle a debt, then in fact she should have the they should have the opportunity to go ahead and sell them. But I'm just happy that they're there. I hope that the fight over who owns them doesn't become so protracted that no one can ever see them. But it sounds like on the surface some more greedy, you know, King family are trying to stop somebody from doing something.
Joe, it just seems the whole story is just weird. Getting King papers to settle a debt from a radio station? I mean, this is kind of parallel universe stuff, isn't it?
Well, it does sound kind of strange. I mean, this radio station was in the same building in Atlanta as the offices of the SCLC. And so there's that, I guess, proximity. But that doesn't explain why a box of papers that presumably should have been in the SCLC office would be in the radio station office. And so I think this question of ownership, that is, did the radio station really have valid ownership of these papers to begin with? You know, that's another question. I mean, that's part of the same question, I should say. So this ownership question has several layers. I hope in the end, though, that these papers do become available to the public, certainly to scholars and to students. Taylor Branch, who, of course, has written detailed histories of the civil rights movement, complains that the papers that remain with the King family are not available to scholars and students. So even though they clearly have a claim on them, one of the problems that I think Mary was alluding to is the fact that the papers that they control are not available to the public, or if not the public, certainly to scholars.
Well, Nat, on that point, you know, it took a coalition of leaders, including Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin, to take the last auction and basically take it back into the public realm instead of letting it go into a private collection. Should everything essentially of this historical value, if these papers are authentic, be somehow kept in a broad domain?
Well, that's a great question, Faraya. I say this, what has complicated an answer to your question is the fact that the King family earlier found the wisdom to sell I Have a Dream to a cellular phone company commercial.
That's
and
right.
Once that happened, I said all bets were off. I mean, you know, why this woman is 80 years old. The King sold the papers, the previous papers, for $32 million. Since you started to commercialize this whole aspect of Dr. King's legacy and his papers, I mean, how come you can't just give the woman who is 80 years old, you know, $300,000 or $100,000? I mean, what's the problem here? Is it money, or is it that you actually want to use the papers to sell them for yourself? I think the matter, the fact that Dr. King is a public figure complicates the notions of copyright. And then, as I said earlier, the fact that we have actually sold it, you know, for a cellular phone commercial makes it really kind of dubious when the family says, hey, wait a minute, what are you doing here?
Yeah, just quickly, we really would need to have and would prefer to have as scholars all those papers together. And since Atlanta now has this collection, I hope some way can be found to pull them all together, whether they pay the person off or whatever they do. It really is essential if we want to preserve the legacy and have people analyze the papers and move on.
All right, Mary. Well, I'm going to try to quickly reintroduce everybody. We got one more topic to get to. Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University. Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Faraya Chidea. We have 4 minutes and 35 seconds to tackle new evidence that Saddam was not linked to al-Qaeda. Now, a declassified Defense Department report says that Saddam Hussein was not cooperating with al-Qaeda. Yet on the same day the report was released, Vice President Dick Cheney went on Rush Limbaugh's radio show and said that al-Qaeda was in Iraq, quote, before we ever launched, meaning the war. So, Mary, will this new report force the administration to drop its allegations about Iraq and al-Qaeda?
No, because there are about 30% of the people who believe anything the administration says, no matter how much evidence there is. The polls show this is another in the long line of who do you trust or whom do you trust. And it shows, again, we don't trust. We can't trust anything that they say. And people have to get over the thinking that Rush Limbaugh and the Weekly Standard or something is news. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. And Cheney is just going to keep on saying this. They've said it over and over. They think that if you repeat a lie enough and just keep on repeating it, it has some kind of persuasive value. But the important thing about this, Farai, is that all those people are dying over there, including Americans like the one you interviewed, people like that who are over there who are committed and think they're serving the country and trying to defend the country. And all these connections have been made to get us into this war, more and more being sent. And these lies keep being told, and we get more and more evidence that there are lies. They ought to take action against Douglas Feith, this undersecretary who wrote this paper that was sent around, that was released in the documents yesterday.
Nat, will this change anything about the state of play on Capitol Hill about Iraq war funding, or does this affect the debate at all?
It does, Farai, although this report is not new and the debate is not new. And I think Mary captured it very well. There's about 28%, Mary, I think, is going down from 30, who will believe everything Cheney says. And you know what's ironic about all this is that the president and the vice president are singing from different hymnals. The president doesn't even say this any longer. The president has moved away from declaring that there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and that there was any relationship at all. I mean, it's very stark to hear the vice president with the fever that he still has for this kind of rhetoric. But I will say, I believe every day when you have reports like this, it makes it more palatable that the country, led this time perhaps by the Democrats, to move us out of Iraq. It makes it easier to sell it.
Okay. Joe, you're going to get the final word. The vice president argued that insurgent Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was an agent of the group al-Qaeda in Iraq before the war. But according to this new intelligence, Zarqawi only allied himself with al-Qaeda after the U.S. invasion. So is the U.S. breeding more alliances between terrorists?
Well, I think there's definitely been that argument can be made in a very strong fashion, certainly when you look at Iraq, because Iraq was not a center of terrorism before the war. And that was the allegations that the administration made, that how much Saddam Hussein was supporting terrorism in the region, terrorism and these links to Iraq specifically. Now, there may have been some, he may have given support to people fighting in the Middle East, but as this report and as others have shown, there was very tenuous, if any, kind of link between Saddam Hussein and Iraq specifically. But now you do have al-Qaeda, very tenuous relationship between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Now you do have al-Qaeda in Iraq, and there's no question about that. There's no question that they've become some very fierce fighters, people who were basically raised in hell there, but that was not the situation before the U.S. invasion in Iraq.
All right, we're going to end it there. And joining us today were Joe Davidson, an editor at The Washington Post, Dr. Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Ervin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University and columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Yep, you too. And as always, if you'd like to comment on any of the topics, you can call us at 202-408-3330 or send us an email. Just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us.